As part of our Leading Edge Group podcast series, Breaking the Mould, I'm here this morning in Toronto with Peter De Jager, an international renowned speaker and writer on the issues relating to change management and problem solving. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Peter, you might give our listeners a snapshot of your formative years living in Canada. Were you born in Ontario? Were your family from the province?
Not a chance. Born in South Africa, raised in Ireland, live in Canada, and then people ask me why I speak on change.
And who did you look up to in those early years and who impressed you? Was it a world-renowned celebrity or was it someone closer to home?
No, there was someone. There was a fellow by the name of Daryl O'Connor who's still out there doing change management. And he was the guy who got me thinking of change management as actually a management skill that you could teach.
Very good. And you completed a BSc in Mathematics and Computer Science in the University of Toronto and worked as a programmer and analyst for a variety of companies. You might fill our listeners in on those details. And were they fulfilling roles, Peter?
Well, I started with IBM. IBM shoveling paper into a printer. I was called a computer operator. And I lasted there about a year, year and a half, I think. And they decided that they wanted me to become a customer engineer. And I said, no, I wanted to be a programmer. So we parted ways. And the rest of my career, until I got to a company called by the name of Dilex, was essentially learning how to use personal computing in a corporate environment. In other words, helping people make the transition from pen and paper to personal computers. That's what I was involved in. That's what really got me interested in change management.
And how long were you in the industry?
I was in the industry a total of about a decade before I started to break out on my own.
And you started your own business in 1990. What was the real inspiration for this?
Well, I'd been going to a particular conference for a number of years as an IT fellow, and they always used to hand out evaluation sheets. And if you give me a blank piece of paper, I'm going to fill it out. And they finally got tired of me and said, Peter, you have so much to say. Why don't you give a talk? And the subtext obviously was, and see how easy it is. Gave my first talk to 600 people, standing room only in the room, standing ovation, and I had more fun than I'd ever had in my life.
And was that in Toronto?
That was in Boston in 1993. '93 is when I went out on my own. Sorry, the first talk I gave was in 1983, Information Center Conference put on by Nancy Weingarten Publications.
Very good. I suppose if you had to synopsize your mission statement on your business, what would it be?
Help people understand that change is not as difficult as we believe. And actually, some of the myths that we have surrounding change make it more difficult for organizations to bring change about in their organizations.
And one of your keynote presentations is Managing the Chaos Brought About by Change. I suppose, what are the key takeaways or learnings from this presentation?
First idea in that particular presentation is that, look, change is difficult. If you get up on a bicycle for the first time, you're going to fall off. And it's that falling off, that transition through incompetence, that organizations find very, very difficult. They find it difficult because they think the incompetence shouldn't be there. So this misconception that chaos can somehow be avoided is what you have to get rid of in your thought process. Once you accept that chaos is going to be the norm for a period of time, then you can ask the question, what can we do to make the chaos more digestible, easier to deal with? And there are lots of techniques that you can do to do that.
But is that not difficult to explain to a logical thinker?
It is in some ways, but this is where storytelling comes into account. Everybody has gone through change. Everybody has experienced the period of transition called chaos. So we all understand it at a very, very deep level. What we seem to have a problem is accepting that that is the norm. We seem to believe for some reason that when we're in chaos, we shouldn't be there.
Yes.
Now, once you get rid of that notion and you say, okay, chaos is going to be how it works. You're going to fall off the bike. You're going to get water up your nose as you're trying to swim. Then it becomes easier to manage in your organization because now you're managing to reality, not falsehood.
But doesn't chaos equal fear?
Chaos can equal that. It also gives the sense of excitement. You're learning how to do something new. You're going to be bad at it in the first place. So put together an infrastructure that helps you through that learning process.
How long does that take?
Depends on the change. If you have a tiny, small change in an organization, you might be able to get through it in 2 or 3 weeks. If you're doing a major corporate reorganization, that could take 2 years before you really get a sense of whether or not the change that you've implemented is actually delivering what you expected it to do.
And are you saying that those 2 years, say for a major corporate change is acceptable?
It's not a matter of it being acceptable. It's a matter of this is what's going to happen.
Okay.
This notion that you can avoid the chaos is what causes a lot of the problems in change management, unreasonable expectations.
And you talk about tearing down a number of myths surrounding the change process. You might explain what some of these are?
One of the biggest myths, and it's even going to sound strange as I say it now, is this myth that people resist change. No, they don't. They get married, they have kids, they move jobs, they move countries, they move houses, they get new degrees, and we do this all voluntarily. No one's pushing us into this. We can embrace huge change, and we do it willingly if it's our change. The myth is we resist change. The reality is we resist being changed, and corporations are really, really good at telling people what to do and not explaining why they're doing it. A lot of the change that we experience in organizations must be dictated. I get that. It's not the ideal way to bring about change, but that's the reality. So I moved on to how do you communicate what a change is all about? And that broke down to 7 questions.
Okay. And so it's all about communication, good communication.
Everything in change management is about communication because you're dealing with people, and people's responses to change are based upon what they know about the change. If they have questions and those questions are not being answered, the change is going to move very, very slowly. If a good manager knows what the questions are, the key questions that people have during change, and then can put together a communications plan to speak to those specific questions, change can be easier in the organization.
But do you not have a certain percentage of your, say, workforce that either will be fence sitters or will be resistant to change for a variety of different reasons?
Absolutely.
And how do you deal with those people?
Well, you have to know who your audience is. Before I announce a change in an organization, I know exactly who is going to respond negatively to the specific change that I mentioned.
Okay.
Those same people might respond very well to a different change. There's this notion that some people resist all types of change. That's actually wrong, because they do get married, they move house, okay, they do this. We respond to specific changes, and we can do it very differently. Up until 2003, I did not own a cell phone, but I owned my first computer back in 1979. In one sense, I'm an early adopter. In another sense, I'm a laggard. I'm the same person.
Okay.
We respond to different changes differently.
You mentioned the 7-step process. Can you?
Well, it's not so much a 7-step process as it is, here are 7 questions that people have.
Okay.
First question is always going to be, why? Why are we doing this? Why are we doing it now? Why have we been successful doing it a different way before? Now you want us to change it? So that's the first question, why? The next one, once they get that answer in their head, is how does it affect me? In other words, what's in it for me? We're selfish.
Yes.
We work to make money to put our kids through school. It's all about us. The next question after those two is Monday. And what I mean by that is, when the change takes place, what exactly will I be doing differently on that day? So don't allow your people to guess what's going to be different. Tell them specifically. You're going to be filling this form out differently. You're going to be reporting to this person rather than that person. You're going to be selling into this region rather than that region. So they need to know specifically what goes on. The next one, so far we have why, what's in it for me, Monday. Next one is won't. What won't change? What can you guarantee to me will remain the same through the chaos? This is how you manage that chaos we mentioned earlier, is help people understand what won't change. Next question is might. What might go wrong during this? Now, we have a tendency in our organization to say, don't worry, everything will be fine. In other words, we're lying. We say that to try and placate people, but it doesn't work. When someone says, don't worry, everything will be fine, we know they're just trying to placate us, so we're actually more concerned. If someone says, what if this goes wrong? The correct response is, that is a probability. It might go wrong. And if it does, here's our plan of attack. Here's how we're going to mitigate that risk.
Okay.
That calms them down. Not this nonsense, don't worry, everything will be fine. The next one is, what will be difficult? This is back to the chaos again. What is going to be difficult? If I'm doing a big bang cutover on some large system, don't tell people that the cutover date is going to go smoothly. It will not. It's going to be problematic. Here's what you do. You put up a process whereby every time someone finds a problem, they get rewarded. the more problems you find, the bigger the reward. That turns your Big Bang cutover from something being scary to actually a competition where you're, you know, what did you find today that broke? Where something that breaks, when we make a mistake, when we're showing our incompetence in a new transition, that is a success. And the last one is signposts. How do we know that we're moving forward towards our goal? That the efforts we're making are actually moving us forward? Because if our people don't see a payback, a return on investment for the things we have to do to make a change happen, they stop.
So honesty in your seven questions, it seems to have a of paramount importance.
Absolutely. And it has an importance because our audiences are not stupid. Our employees are not stupid. When we lie to them, when we don't tell them the truth, they know that we're doing something. If in your organization you had a 100% trust between management and staff, change would be easy.
Okay.
But we don't. Therefore, we have to backfill with all the information that we can make available to them.
And Peter, having spoken in more than 40 countries, you're recognized worldwide as an exciting and engaging speaker. So what's your magic formula in relation to your presentation skills?
It ties into change management, surprisingly. If I'm speaking to an audience, there is one single goal when I'm speaking. I must be answering the questions that are in people's minds. Now, if that means I have to use a little bit of the Socratic questioning method, where I ask questions in order to raise questions in your head, that's what I do. When I'm presenting, my goal is to get you engaged mentally with what I'm saying. And if that requires a little bit of theater, if it requires fun, if it requires play acting, storytelling on stage, then I'll do that. My tendency is never to use PowerPoint, never to use bullet points, is simply to get up there, be the visual, ask questions, and then roll with the answers, and I have a bit of fun.
Very good. And Peter, you point out in your presentations the contradictions between our stated beliefs and our demonstrated behaviors. Can you expand on that?
Well, the one I gave you already is this. If I ask a room full of people, raise your hand if you think this is a true statement, people resist a change, all the hands go up. So that's their stated belief, and that means they'll manage according to that belief. If I believe that you will resist change, then the only way for me to manage is to tell you what to do. And there's the irony. It's we don't resist change. What we resist is being changed. Here's a bit of a reality. If you define a problem to someone and they accept that the problem is real, what do they immediately start doing? Immediately start thinking of, if I were king for a day, this is what I would do to solve that problem. So they're already thinking about change. You describe a problem, get someone to nod their heads, and then you can ask them the first question. What would you do to fix this? And the moment they give you an answer, that person is now involved in the change process. I use exactly the same techniques when I'm up on stage.
Good. Now, there is so much change evident in our political climate, with presidents tweeting and using social media as the main conveyor of news. And what's your... Very interested, Peter, your opinion on this.
We are being deluged with news items every single day. And quite frankly, I think a lot of people are just fatigued. It's very chaotic. And unlike a planned change where we know where we're trying to get to, the chaos is not serving any useful purpose that I can see. Every day, it's the same thing.
But
if you wake up and you ask, damage report.
But if you were private secretary to the president, would you tell him or would you advise him to stop tweeting?
Oh, that's the number one bit of advice he's been given left, right and centre, but he's not paying any attention.
Okay.
He's not paying any attention.
Okay. The role of technology to affect change. This overly positive, or are there any downsides?
Oh, it's always positive and negative. You know, technology does what we allow it to do. There are huge changes coming down the pike. The whole artificial intelligence expert systems are going to change the world the likes of which we have never seen before. I know that's been said in the past, but this is different. AI, deep thinking, is going to change everything. Look, I play the Japanese game of Go. I've played it most of my life. I'm a rank amateur at that game. And if you had asked people in the industry 5 years ago, how long do you think it'll take before a computer can beat a professional player at this game? The estimates were 25 to 50 years. Well, beginning of last year, a computer program played the best player in the world 5 times in a row and beat him soundly 5 times in a row. That is unprecedented. That is unbelievable. Now, when you take that same type of computer program, the way it learned, the way it taught itself, and you apply it to other activities, it will move just as quickly. We're heading into a rather strange time. I have no idea how it's going to go. I do know that governments around the world are surprisingly quickly looking at things like guaranteed incomes. And they're doing that for a very simple reason. If 40, 50% of your people are unemployed and unemployable because they do not have the training for the new world, they have to still make a living. They still have to be able to feed themselves. Because if they don't, then you have 40, 50% of the population marching in the streets.
And are you going to see more and more people working 3-day weeks or 4-day weeks?
That's always been predicted. I don't see it happening.
You don't?
The organizations don't think like that. We've had that prediction for more than 100 years, is that the work week's going to decrease. If anything, it's expanded. Most people have their phone all the time. They're checking it all the time. They're getting emails all the time. There's nothing in the wind that's going to say, no, we're going to make a line between work and life. It's just not going to happen. Corporations aren't interested. Now, what they are going to do, there will be less work available because there will be more robots and machines to do what we're currently doing. So will we be working less? Yes, but not for the reasons that we had in the past, where we'd have leisure time.
Yes.
This will be, you can't get work, so there's less of it.
More and more organizations and corporations are recruiting younger people, and people that are more mature in years with a lot of experience end up on the scrap heap. Can you see any change in that mentality?
There's supposed to be changes that are happening there, but I do not see it. Older people, people with years and years and years of experience, also come with an expectation that they will be given benefits, that is full-time work. If you go into any bank in Canada, there may be 20 or 30 people in that branch. There might be no one in that branch who's a full-time employee drawing benefits. Everyone in that branch is part-time, working less than 30 hours, no benefits, no pension accrual, and this has been going on now for years. This part-time, temporary, unstable work is becoming the norm these days. And you look at the young kids coming out of university and you say, what's their life? When are they going to be able to get a job, put money away for a pension? What happens to their life? Because it's very different than it used to be.
And is there any upside to that, in that people have more time, quality of life, balance between work and that?
If they had the finances to support that, yes. I mean, if you've got a good job, if you're wealthy and you can only have to work 20 hours a week, great, wonderful life. But if the 20 hours you're working, because that's all you can get, is minimum wage, well, then you can't even pay for rent.
Okay.
So while you have more time off, there's not much you can do with it if you don't have the finances to support that time off.
So will that create eventually upheaval?
This is why governments are looking at guaranteed income.
Okay.
This is their first approach to how do we solve this. I mean, there have been other suggestions. One of them is that robots, machines, should pay taxes. Well, the notion is if you've displaced a person who was paying taxes and you've taken that work away, well, you've also taken the taxes away. This is why a lot of countries around the world, their infrastructure is beginning to fall apart. We're not replacing things as we should. And sooner or later, you got to pay the piper. So, you know, when the bridge falls down, what do you do? This has to be funded. Where's it going to be funded from?
What is your position, Peter, on climate change?
What we do is we keep shooting ourselves in the foot every now and then with someone who fudges the data for some reason or other. That isn't helping the cause, because every time that happens, then it taints the entire body of work. The reality is that the discussion is closed. Climate change is happening. We need to do more. The good news is we are. We are beginning to do more. China, surprisingly, is fast moving towards eco-friendly energy sources. Countries in Europe have windmills everywhere, solar collectors everywhere. We are moving. It doesn't help that the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Accords. But even then, there's been a backlash, where states and cities have said, regardless of whether we're in the Paris Accords or not, we're going to meet those goals. So there's a bit of a backlash against you-know-who and this whole notion that we don't have to worry about climate change. As to whether or not it's too late, we'll see.
Okay.
But there is good things happening. And also the technology is helping.
And are they happening in your homeland, in Canada?
They're happening everywhere. You know, they're happening in Canada. If you head out on the western side of Ontario, we have wind farms that have thousands of windmills. So we're beginning to get it. We still have the pipeline discussions and the oil sands discussions, but those two will get resolved. I mean, there has been a turning point. Building a pipeline these days is not as easy as it was before, and while we can argue about jobs, the other argument is about the life down the line.
So I feel that you're more positive than negative in relation to...
In climate change, yes. There's a certain positivity because we are doing a tremendous amount. It doesn't get enough publicity. When you have Norway and other countries saying that they're 70%, 80%, 90% replacing fossil fuels with this stuff, those are all good numbers.
Okay, good. And finally, what does the future hold for Peter de Jager? And is there any piece of wisdom that you would like to impart to our listeners, Peter?
Look, I'm 62. I'm heading towards retirement. There's future and everything for me. I'm slowing down a little bit in my level of energy on the work. I still continue to speak. My topic will remain change management. As to advice for the listener, change is not as difficult as we make it out to. If we understand change in and of itself as a topic, our changes in our organizations will get a little bit easier. Here's the mistake we make. Large organization wants to bring in a new technology, and they start worrying about the technological aspects of the technology and what it's going to cost. And they say, okay, now we're going to roll out that technology. And what's missing in all of that discussion is, how well do we understand how people respond to change? How many change books have they read in advance of trying to bring a change about? And sadly, in most organizations, the answer is none. You know, we're a technologist, we're eager, we have an answer, we want to implement it. What's the problem? Well, the problem is you don't understand how change works, and we need to understand. I'll give you an example. Technology is usually sold on benefits. Great. And we think that works. Ooh, tell people what it does and why you should do it, and they'll embrace it. 1601, Captain James Lancaster, scurvy. He hears a rumor that lemonade will get rid of scurvy. He performs an experiment. 4 ships, 3 months. On the one ship where he is, everybody gets lemonade. The other 3 ships, everybody has scurvy at the end of the trip. They don't. They write a letter to the British Admiralty. Lemonade cures scurvy. Scurvy has killed more than 2 million people at this point. How long do you think it took for the British Admiralty to embrace the change of lemonade? Well, it wasn't 2 weeks. It was 200 years. Now, that contradicts any notion that selling change just on its benefits is sufficient.
It's sufficient.
There are other things that we need to do when trying to bring a change about. If you do that, if you understand how change works, you can bring change about very, very quickly. There are more iPads and iPhones on the planet today than there are people. That happened in less than a decade and a half.
Well, Peter, I would listen to you all day, and I've no doubt our listeners will be privileged to hear you speaking. Will you speak in Ireland anytime soon?
I'd hope to get back there in October. It looks like I'm going to get back there in early January.
Very good.
We'll see. It's always up in the air. The best way to contact me is pdeager, pdeager, at technobility.com. technobility.com.
But Peter, I would like to thank you for participating in this podcast and for sharing your insights into the areas surrounding change management and provoking thought and giving us a sneak view into the future. Thank you, Peter, and looking forward to listening in to your future webcasts. Thank you.
Take care, guys. Thanks.